While I want to speak, especially this morning, to Tim and Scott and Michael, you all get to join in, because any of you who work anywhere, whether you work for somebody, or whether you supervise people, or if you're really in any sort of power relationship at all, that is, you're a child of somebody, you're a parent to somebody, any of us who just live human life at all can definitely get some things out of what I want to do this morning, but I especially want to address my three brothers in the ministry here. Our scripture readings this morning alert us to some attitudes and practices that are crucial not only to ordained ministry, as I've said, but to leadership of any kind. They help us understand things and actually paint a picture of a kind of ministry that has its roots in things like peace and confidence, like I've made you an iron pillar, a bronze wall. These are metaphors that were meant to paint a picture for somebody like Jeremiah, who was worried about what was happening in his life, that you're safe. Now, this is going to be a recurring theme, because spouses manipulate their spouse when they feel unsafe. And bosses are cruel when they feel like something in the bottom line is being threatened. You can reduce almost all human anger, almost all human manipulation, almost all dehumanizing of others to something that makes us afraid inside. And then when you add that to we're willing to do whatever it takes to not have that feeling, well, that's the recipe for leadership disaster. So I want to talk this morning just quickly about three things that I think we need to do, those of us who are leaders in the church, or as I said, in any area of human life, and three things that I think we can't do that come out of these scriptures for me. So the first one is, we cannot strive to win. Because once you strive to win, it sets an ethos, a vibe in a church in which kind of the open secret that's all too common in abuse in churches is that somebody gets the attitude of, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to win. I don't like what the vestry's doing, and I think I'm right, and I'm so sure that I'm right that I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make sure what I see is right happens. Or a pastor thinks that, or somebody in the church. It doesn't matter. What I want you to see this morning is that what's underneath that is always anger, contempt, or hate. And then those kinds of things, I feel angry, you're impeding my progress. Therefore, feeling contempt for people, maybe even going all the way to hatred, that is the root of doing whatever it takes to stop someone who you think is impeding your progress or thwarting your will. And once we've made that decision that we're willing to do anything, then that means we're willing to harm others for the sake of the cause. Well, what's behind that kind of thinking? Because if you think about it, no leader is intentionally mean. No leader that I ever know woke up in the morning and said, hey, I know what I'll do. I think I'll be mean to the vestry or the staff this week. I mean, that's never what's going on. So what is going on? I think it's a lack of confidence. And you either really believe that God has called you and that he will protect you, or you don't. I mean, that is where the rubber meets the road. And that's what shapes behavior. Behavior is always just an exterior manifestation of something that's going on inside of us. What happens to the leaders that I've seen who become mean, just to put it plainly, is that the end seduces and deceives them. And it then justifies any kind of mean. It becomes a really powerful rationale for doing whatever it takes. Because when we don't feel essentially safe inside, even when we say, Lord, even if everybody else flees from you, I won't. And then what happens to Peter? His legs begun to run away before his brain could catch up, right? Something was very deep inside of him that transcended his verbal vows of I'll do different, I'll be better than everybody else. I think he meant it. I don't think he was being some sort of raging hypocrite. But when the moment was on, when it came time to actually perform, you might say, or do something, before his conscious mind could stop him, he acted out of the deep inner reality from which actions always come. Right? Isn't this what Jesus taught us? A good tree cannot produce bad fruit. Its inner DNA wouldn't allow that to happen. This is why he confronted the Pharisees about, you wash the outside of the cup, but you leave the inside untouched. This is why Jesus says it's not things exterior to you that defile you, but it's things that come out from within you that defile you. And this is what ends up making leadership dysfunctional. If we don't have a deep subconscious sense that you are safe, if you do not feel that, when the rubber meets the road, then you will act the way unsafe people act. You will act the way people who are threatened act. What's necessary is we get to the place where we're just utterly and perfectly safe. And in a sense, we cannot be threatened. And this may shock you a little bit, but you actually get to the place where you kind of become indifferent to yourself. Not completely, obviously, but you get to the place where it's just, most things are just okay. And that God must have put that bronze wall here, and that I'm still protected, but he's allowing this to happen. Think of it this way, if we're thinking about not striving to win, what if you've already won? Before Jesus metaphorically ever put on a stole, before Jesus metaphorically ever put on an alb, he heard his father say to him, you are my son, and with you I am well pleased. What if you've already won? What if you could actually get up every day acting out of this deep inner consciousness that you've already won? This is what is actually true. This is why the first word in Jeremiah is God's calling. This is what it means when he says, before I even formed you in the womb, I knew you. He's giving him a knowledge of his value, calling, and purpose, and you want to act out of that. Act out of a deep knowledge of your already existing value, your calling, and your purpose. Second thing we absolutely cannot do is to manipulate. And this really is just one of the aspects of doing whatever it takes to win. When you see leaders manipulating, it just means that they're trying to control others by kind of artful, unfair, insidious means and doing it for their own advantage. And so they give people an appearance of a decision, but people don't really have a real choice in the matter. But I just sort of get people to do what I want them to do, and I make it feel like they're, you know, they actually have a say in the matter. And that may work once, and it may even work twice. And actually, it could work 20 times, but at some point, that is going to poison the church. And it will actually just create an atmosphere in which no one tells the truth and everyone manipulates. We cannot do it. Number three, many people who come into leadership for the first time think they need power. And so they go to all kinds of machinations to somehow grab power, thinking that if I can get power, then I can do what I need to do. And so they think that power will somehow create for them a force of leverage so that they can do what they want to do. But again, we cannot do this. It pollutes our work from the outset. And it makes us as leaders untrustworthy. It puts a political spin on things, and it makes the people we're trying to lead feel used and not loved. But if you look at Jesus' model, he didn't grab for power as a means to an end, but rather he lived in this God-bathed reality that the psalmist talked about this morning, or that the assurance that God was giving Jeremiah, or the model that Jesus was commending to the 12, or what you heard in Paul of, I became a servant to everyone. He lived in this God-bathed reality that facilitated servanthood. And then he commended it to his disciples because Jesus knew what was really real. That's why in the garden he could say to Peter, Peter, put away your sword. Do you not see? See, Jesus was seeing a reality that no one else saw. He was saying, Peter, do you not see that I could call on myriads of angels to make me safe if I felt unsafe? But I don't feel unsafe. Even in the face of arrest, even in the face of unfair trials, even in the face of mockings and unfair charges, I do not feel unsafe. Put your sword away. See, this is actually, guys, a very practical knowledge. It's not Christian mysticism. It's not Christian pop therapy. It is a very deep and practical knowledge that somebody is actually in control. But the way we typically respond is, you know, if God's first word is, hey, I knew you and I'm going to protect you, When we feel called to a divine work, typically what we see is our human limitations. And we start to beg off like Jeremiah did. I mean, Jeremiah is only telling the truth when he says, I don't know how to speak. And I'm sure each one of you, you carry around in you an I don't know how to that makes you feel vulnerable. So what are you going to do when you feel vulnerable? You've got a choice. You either act as if you're really not, that God will somehow pull all this together even when you feel genuinely vulnerable, or not. When Jeremiah says, I'm too young, he's only telling the truth. Those were both true things. I'm only a boy. Or maybe, ladies, you might say, I'm only a woman. And what's happening here is that God's first word hits us like this, and we see these new challenges, and these new challenges produce in us a lack of self-confidence. And of course, this makes sense. How can one have confidence when one has no track record? You've never been a deacon before. How in the world are you going to walk out of here in confidence? You've never done it. If I asked you to go hit a golf ball the way Phil Mickelson hits a golf ball, you probably wouldn't feel very confident about that. You've never done it. You've never done this. So what are you going to do when God calls you to do something and you've never done it? Where are you going to get the confidence? And this is what these passages are telling us this morning, that this new level of trust is born in what God says he's already done for us. Before Jesus ever said or did a word publicly, he heard his Father say, you are my sons, and with you I am well pleased. And it's out of that that both effective and ethical leadership comes. Therefore, there's three things we have to do if we're to live into these scriptures this morning. The first one is, whenever you don't know what to do, whenever you're stuck, you're talking to your wife, you're talking to your husband, you're at a grocery store, you're at work, you're supervising or not, whenever you're stuck and you don't know what to do, practice the golden rule. Don't treat that clerk the way you would not want to be treated, in a way that you wouldn't want to be treated. Whenever you're stuck and you don't know what to do at work and you're dealing with a subordinate, treat them the way you'd want to be treated if you were in their position. This is whenever you feel stuck. This is like your ace you just keep in your pocket all the time. You'll never go wrong. Whenever you feel stuck, if you don't know what to do, practice the golden rule. And 99% of the time, you'll have it right just doing that. Second, practice the great commandment. I think that as you go, and this is a standard that I hold myself to daily. I don't always hit it, but it's one I hold myself to daily. That your leadership should be judged not only on the accomplishing of tasks, but on the quality of person you become and the kind of community you create in the accomplishing of those tasks. That is the real measurement of leadership, especially of Christian leadership. It's just not getting anything done. Because if getting things done is the measure, well then manipulate, lie, grab power, do whatever it takes to get it done if that's the measure. But that's not the measure. The measure is what kind of person are you becoming and what kind of community are you creating in the accomplishing of ministry. Here's a final sort of freeing thought, not only for you three gentlemen, but for all of you. Our projects, starting a church, starting churches, being rectors of churches and assistant rectors and deacons in churches and whatever you do, those projects are hardly ever God's project. Did you catch that? Those projects are not God's project. We are God's project. God is creating a people for himself, a set of cooperative friends. The only thing that's going to last forever are the kinds of people we become as leaders and the kinds of people our followers become in the pursuit of whatever it is you say your vision is and whatever it is you say your calling to your task is. Of all the things I do, and I do a lot of things, I am happily husband to Debbie. I am devoted father to Jonathan and Carol. I'm a son and a brother to a family, and I'm a pastor and an author and a professor and a speaker and a bishop, and I've probably forgotten something. There's a lot of stuff I do, but I try to do that when my head is screwed on straight and I'm thinking straight, is what is the kind of person I am becoming in the pursuit of those various tasks. Because the only thing that's going to last, the only thing that goes to heaven with me when I die, not you guys. And if Holy Trinity becomes this, let's say Holy Trinity becomes this great church, and at some point somewhere here in Orange County, we've got this amazingly beautiful chapel, you know, with warm wood and stone, and are you following me here? And we've got, you know, we're grounded, we're situated, we've got, you know, surplus parking. Right, are you with me here? Well, that is not going to last. I don't care how great it is. No one can go to me. I don't think anybody can go to, let's say, Turkey and put their foot on where there was a church 1,900 years ago. They don't last. But you know who's in the great cloud of witnesses right now? The people who started that church in ancient Turkey 1,950 years ago, because that's what God is building, a people. Never forget it. Last thing, this is some language that I culled out of the Renovare Study Bible, a favorite of mine, and it's my charge to you, Tim, Scott, Michael. As your bishop, I charge you in your leadership to practice loving, thoughtful, and active promotion of the good of others and the causes of God in your world. Through this, you are going to experience many little deaths. Many little deaths of going beyond yourself and beyond where you feel safe. And may these little deaths and this actual safety that you find in them make you truly free to serve others with a genuine, spirit-led love, never expecting anything in return.